Welcome to the latest podcast from the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Today we're going to talk about one of those crazy, really easy, simple, complicated, overly discussed, I don't know, topics. Filtration.
I'm really excited. I love filtration, you guys. There's so much interesting science to it, but so many interesting practical solutions to it too. So it's a really fun subject to me.
It's so basic, but so much happens. So much goes on.
Well, it's not basic, but it is essential. Like, yeah. You can learn a little bit about it enough to be functional, or you could study this subject and know everything about it. And there's a ton to it.
Right.
So there's so many layers to this topic.
So we're going to talk about, what is a filter? What does it do? What does it need to do?
What does it not do?
I need a filter to clean my aquarium. And then we're going to talk about a bunch of the different types of filtrations and some of the pros and cons of those.
Yeah. So what is filtration?
What is filtration? So one of my favorite interview questions when we're talking to somebody about, hey, do you want to come work at the aquarium store, is, can you identify the three types of filtrations? And usually the first word out of somebody's mouth is
and their faces, their eyes just get right. So they're terrified, because most people don't know like the context of that question.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Is it under gravel and a fluval and
I'm pretty sure for that question in my interview, I told you I have no idea what you're asking me.
Which is a much better answer than under gravel or a fluval.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I just went like, the nitrogen cycle.
I remember that question.
You nailed it.
Yeah,
you rattled it off like it was second nature.
Yeah, you already knew it. That was cheating.
Right. Now this will be a test of, anybody who wants to interview. If they've listened to the podcast, which if I was preparing for a job, I might think about that.
Mm-hmm.
They'll know.
So, they might have gotten your other questions too. Have we talked about those?
Ooh, I don't know.
Honestly, if they did, I would be really impressed.
that's true.
I do know topic of one question in my interview was discussed in another podcast.
Yeah, we did. So if you want to work at Watercolors, go back and try
listen
and find
to the podcast. If our listening audience drops after this, we should be concerned. Okay, sorry, we digress. Three types of filtration. What are the three types of filtration? Mechanical, chemical, and biological. What the heck does that mean?
So how do you know if you have a mechanical, biological, or chemical filter?
Right. That's the big question. Okay, super simplify it, though. If you have a filter that does those three things, you have a successful filter.
Yeah.
It doesn't clean your aquarium. It filters stuff out.
Right. That's the confusion that a lot of people have about filtration. It's not to make your tank clean. It's basically filtration just removes things from your water.
Right. I need a better filter so that I don't have to clean my aquarium.
Yeah.
How do you relate that to a dog? Like, I need a better something so I don't have to do anything with my dog.
I know. Like, what do you get for your dog so you don't have to pick up its poop? That's basically what it is.
Yeah. You hire a poop cleaning service. So for your aquarium, if you don't want to clean your aquarium, you hire an aquarium maintenance company.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly.
Okay, so let's define them quick. Mechanical filtration is kind of the obvious one. And that mechanically takes out the stuff you can see. That's the particulates you see floating in the water that a mechanical something, a filter pad, usually, mm-hmm. removes.
Yeah, some sort of sponge or anything that you can pass water through that will catch.
Right, catching stuff, catching mm-hmm. junk.
Like mm-hmm. a filter sock.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, a filter sock, or in my favorite hang-on-the-back filters in AquaClear, it would be the sponge.
Yeah.
To grab stuff. Chemical filtration is going to be a little bit more complicated, but the simple answer to chemical filtration is to absorb chemicals, which is a really broad term and means all kinds of different things to all kinds of different people, but it filters out the impurities. So carbon is the classic example of chemical, the most widely known example of chemical filtration in an aquarium. And I would say that's the least important.
I think chemical filtration is a solution to a problem, not a standard part of a healthy aquarium.
Yeah.
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 That's how I think about it.
In a reef tank, it gets a little more complicated than that.
Right.
But in a, if you're doing a basic saltwater tank or a breeder tank.
Yeah. In a reef tank, a lot of that is about like basically minimizing the amount of water changes you have to do.
Yeah. Reducing the size. Yeah, I agree. All right. And then biological filtration, by far, without question, the most important type of filtration that happens in an aquarium.
Yeah.
Which is the processing of organic waste or the nitrogen cycle, which we've talked about.
Yes.
We'll go into it again in this because you can't.
Yeah, we did do a YouTube video about the nitrogen cycle, just sort of introducing the subject and letting you know how to use it. But we will definitely get into that a little bit more in this.
So what that means is the most important filter in your aquarium, the most important part of your filtration system in your aquarium, is basically a good home for bacteria. That's it.
Yeah. And that's easy to establish and easy to maintain.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I think it's important to say up top, like, if you add something to your aquarium, you should know how you're taking it out. As in, if you're adding food, that's converted into different chemical things through different chemical processes, but it's not coming out unless you do your water changes. Everything you add, like for every action, you need that equal and opposite reaction.
I like that.
So unless you know how that thing is coming out, then you just have to assume it stays in there. Fish food stays in there. Fish poop stays in there. And unless you're taking it out by filtration, you're taking it out manually via water changes.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. Okay, so look, we're going to go back to my AquaClear filter because we're going to pick on AquaClear. Yes, I'm a huge fan of AquaClear filters. First, here's why they don't use filter cartridges. I'm not a fan. We're not a fan here.
Boo.
The reason we don't like filter cartridges, is it too soon for that discussion?
No, not at all.
So the reason we don't like filter cartridges here is because the class, I'm not going to pick on this company, but the classic filter with the filter cartridge had one filter cartridge, one slot for a filter cartridge. And you'd put your filter cartridge in there and you'd keep it in there for a month to 6 weeks. I think it was change your filter cartridge every 4 weeks was the recommendation from this particular company. And so with the most important part of filtration for your aquarium being home for bacteria, that flossy super surface area stuff on the outside of the filter cartridge is pretty decent home for bacteria, pretty good spot for bacterial filtration to grow. And from one perspective, those cartridges had that filtery stuff also mechanically would collect the junk, the stuff you could see, and it had carbon in it. There's all three, right? Except every month you take out that home for bacteria and you throw it away. And you put it in a brand new one that doesn't have any bacteria on it.
Yeah. I think people get into the habit of that because they use filters for their home water that they're drinking or whatever.
Right.
But those are carbon filters. That's chemical filtration. Of course you're going to throw that away every month. You can't mash all the types of filtration together and call them the same.
And you're not recirculating the water. You're just pulling some impurities out of some of your tap water.
Yeah. It's not equivalent at all.
Doesn't count.
You're not living and breathing in it.
Right.
Yeah. That's a great point, Charles, is that like our aquarium water, like the type of water that you would drink or an animal would drink or whatever is completely different than the water that you're going to absorb through your skin and breathe. That's much harder requirements for that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big motivator in like how I handle water changes and stuff, because in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, well, they are living and breathing in this. And I cognitively think to myself, what am I comfortable living and breathing in?
Yeah.
I get annoyed when I'm stuck inside with like the AC because it's just the same air, you know?
If you lived in a plastic bubble, how would you want to maintain your air quality?
Right. So that's why we don't like cartridge filters. And that's why we go back to the aquaclear filters, which have three different filter blocks that address all three types of filtration. It's like aquaclear gets it or something.
Yeah.
They have their sponge, which is their mechanical filtration, which, by the way, also grows some good bacteria. They have their little carbon bags, which address their chemical filtration. And then they have those little ceramic media things that are just covered with all kinds of holes and pores and all kinds of places for good bacteria to live. That's the core of the filtration for an aquaclear. And they go all the way up the line, like their canister filters do all that stuff too.
Sure.
Lots of other companies, by the way, have gotten away from exclusively cartridge filters and come up with some other solutions for that. Seachem's titles do that, I think, pretty well.
Yeah. And I think by and large, even the filters that do use cartridges often encourage you to swap one out at a time, like they do two. Yeah. Or I know a certain brand has like that bio wheel thing that you change out at a different time. And that to me is still a little iffy. Like, I would just rather have my filtration be my filtration.
Right.
But at least it's sort of addressing those problems.
It makes it a consumable good. And that's really, I think, the big draw for companies to produce cartridge filters is it's a consumable good. You have to keep buying a new one.
Yeah, good filtration should last you, with some change out, pretty much forever.
Right.
I have often gotten the question of how long, like all my freshwater tanks right now run on sponge filters, so that's going to be the example I'm using here.
Yeah.
How long do these last? And I was like, I don't know. Until
they fall apart.
Until they fall apart. Yeah. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I'll let you know when I find out.
Yeah.
In the case of our Severum tank, when the Severums eat all the sponge.
Yeah. Is that what they're doing now? Yeah. Eating the sponge?
Did you see that? Did you see that one?
No. Yeah. I love it. Like, the audacity of that.
God.
Eat the filter.
They're eating it.
Yeah. We don't need this.
Don't you know that keeps you alive? Come on, man.
But even that good filtration, if you've got good biological filtration, that goes beyond your first tank. I think people have a really hard time cycling that first tank. There's a lot of drama and emotions, and it can be really difficult. But once you get that first tank cycled, like, if you wonder why multiple tank syndrome kicks in, it's because you use that first tank to start the next one and you realize how much easier it is.
So, <Way smoother. laughs>
because once you establish that biological filtration, you're keeping pet bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you keep them alive, you've got a lot of them.
And plenty.
That makes you very flexible as an aquarist.
I have had it where people have come in complaining about the fact that their tank's not cycling, tank's not cycling, tank's not cycling, which for this particular couple that I'm going to use as an example, it was because they were trying to keep everything so incredibly spotless.
Yeah.
And they would come in and they would bring in their water sample and there'd be a hint of ammonia, barely any, zero nitrite, zero nitrite. Finally, I said, okay, don't do a water change for 2 weeks and take this rock out of my established aquarium. It happened to be a piece of lava rock, you know, all the little holes.
Mm, perfect.
Yep. And they put it in their tank. And 3 days later, they came back in the shop and said, in 3 days, we went from having slight ammonia, zero nitrate, to zero ammonia, zero nitrite, and 10 nitrate.
That's amazing. Those little organisms are like mind-blowing how well they work and how successful they are.
Right.
Yeah, maybe that's probably a good chance for us to talk about what that test means, the nitrogen cycle.
The nitrogen cycle. Charles did a fantastic YouTube video on the nitrogen cycle. Charles, summarize that for us.
Yeah. So fish waste is predominantly ammonia. So then there's a genus of bacteria, I think it's pronounced Nitrosomonas, and they take ammonia and convert that into nitrite, which
essentially they eat ammonia and poop out nitrite.
And it is still super toxic, though. So then there's a second genus of bacteria called Nitrobacter, which convert nitrite into nitrate, and that is toxic, but only in really stupid quantities.
That's the sign usually of somebody who doesn't do water changes.
Yeah.
Or feeds way too much
to an established aquarium.
Yeah.
Right.
Fun fact about the YouTube video, if you look at the drawing, I drew different like shapes for the bacteriums. That's actually me trying to emanate their different body cell styles of bacteria between those two genera.
Cute. Very cute.
Getting those bacteria to grow on a surface is the process of cycling an aquarium. And the more surface area you have for those to grow, the more you're going to get.
Best examples for that are saltwater tanks. I mean, most of the bulk of saltwater filtration, at least on the biological level, is in live rock. Super porous rocks with a lot of water flowing through them. I mean, our hang-on-the-back filters are basically like mini live fish-only live rock systems, right. Honestly, because it's just porous media with water flowing through it.
Right. You could get away with a saltwater aquarium moving water around live rock.
Mm-hmm.
Done. And water changes.
And too many water changes. Why we add on filtration.
That's why we have protein skimmers. That's why we have media reactors. That's why we have big, huge refugiums. That's why we have all of those things added onto a reef tank, so that we can do smaller water changes comparatively. So the comparison there would be, if you are setting up a 10-gallon breeder tank where you're going to try and breed, we'll go with zebra danios. You're going to put a sponge filter in there and a bunch of zebra danios and something for them to lay eggs in. That sponge filter will accomplish mechanical filtration because it will pull in the junk, and it will accomplish biological filtration because all kinds of good nitrosoma and nitrobacter bacteria can grow all over that surface of that sponge. There's no chemical filtration happening on a sponge filter. It only addresses two of the three types of filtration. So if you want to breed the heck out of zebra danios, 50% water changes once a week.
I will argue, if you breed zebra danios the way that we would recommend, you are also offering chemical filtration. Because you probably have a huge mound of Java moss in there, and that is converting some of that waste into safer materials.
Absolutely true. So I should have used zebra cichlids.
that would have been harder for me to argue against. But you can get all three in, even if you're using something as simple as a sponge filter.
And that's true. Basically how I run my freshwater tanks.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it works. That's great
so
filtration.
So then you're using your sponge as your mechanical and your biological filtration, and your plants as your chemical filtration. Mm-hmm. Still have to do water changes.
Yes.
Now, the point I was trying
still
to make
do.
With that
I'm sorry.
was on that 20-gallon breeder tank where we're breeding the heck out of these fish that eat the heck out of plants, so you can't put any chemical filtration media in it. The sponge filter is fine, and because it's freshwater, doing a 50% water change on a 20-gallon freshwater aquarium doesn't take very long and doesn't really cost much at all, because just plain straight good tap water is cheap.
Yeah, probably a penny maybe, right. You know. If you get really bad
a penny
water
and a
prices.
Half if you include Prime.
Yeah.
There we go. So now we switch to the other half of that analogy, and we have our 200-gallon reef aquarium. And let's just pretend we have a circulating something to move the water around that live rock, which that live rock, well, see, there's going to be your biological filtration. And you've got pumping it through a filter sock to catch your mechanical stuff. Now you want to start doing 50% water changes on that reef system to make up for the fact that you don't have any chemical filtration media. That's going to get expensive.
Jeez, yeah, let's call it super cheap and say $60 for 200 gallons of salt water. Like, that's super cheap.
Well, it'd be 75 cents a gallon if you bought it from us.
Yeah, that would be cheaper. I mean,
So that's $75, right? That's how that math works.
Yeah.
For a 50% water change.
Yeah. So we're not recommending, I think salt water gets so mystified.
It
like
does.
You need all these fancy, magical, bubbling things. And, you know, it looks scary. But the reason that we do that is because it saves us money. Spending $200 on a protein skimmer up front saves you 50% water changes. Saves you all the extra work and money you're going to have to spend to do those water changes.
And so just quickly off the top of my head, Let's say that a 50% water change on a 200-gallon tank cost you $75. If you spend $200 on a protein skimmer, that means that by the time you've not done three water changes that you would have had to done without it, you're already saving money.
So yeah. don't get us wrong here. We are not saying you don't have to do water changes on a saltwater aquarium.
Yeah.
Okay. You have to do water changes on a saltwater aquarium.
Absolutely. Yep.
Absolutely, without question. People are going to argue that point, and I will argue that anytime you say, well, I've met all these parameters, so I don't have to do water change, and look how good it looks, I will say 2 points. One, how long will it last, and how much better would it be if you did do water changes?
That's the thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But instead of 50% water changes, you could do 10 or 20% water changes on that 200-gallon saltwater aquarium.
Yeah, and maybe instead of every week, you can do every other week. Yeah.
And that's what I meant by water changes. Right. You wouldn't have to
I just wanted to make sure that we weren't, you know, we weren't saying, hey, a saltwater tank without a protein skimmer, you need 50% water changes. A saltwater tank with a protein skimmer, you don't have to do water changes at all. No, that's not what we're saying.
But that's a case of better filtration means easier maintenance.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's the case in pretty much every type of aquarium.
Better filtration means easier maintenance. Can I argue with that? I mean, to a point, you're right.
But I would say that, just to be clear, though, that doesn't mean better filtration means no maintenance.
Right. That might be my biggest issue. It's so common to get people
it's
out
dangerous.
Here. I want a really easy tank that I don't have to clean.
If I put on, I have a 20-gallon. If I put on a filter rated for an 80-gallon, will that mean that I don't have to do water changes?
The short answer is no.
No. It will mean, and as somebody who keeps mostly planted aquariums, it's very much true because I consider my plants a big part of my filter.
Absolutely.
I consider my substrate a big part of my filter.
Absolutely.
So if I have a ton of plants and really well-established mature ones and keep lower stocks of fish, that absolutely means less maintenance for me. Not if you have no plants, 50 fish, and overfeed, having a giant filter on that tank does not make a difference.
It does not.
No.
Nope.
Because all you'll end up with is just more nitrates. That's the farthest a fill can get you is nitrates. It can't do much more than
right.
that.
Right. The plants can take out a lot of nitrates.
Yeah.
Not all of them.
No.
But you still have to replenish things that the plants need. The plant, all of the stuff. So here's the big. This is the big argument in saltwater right now. That if I have my 200-gallon aquarium, I have a big, huge protein skimmer, I have a meaty reactor, two meaty reactors, one with carbon that I don't use all the time, intermittently. We'll talk about carbon later, and one with some kind of phosphate-absorbing filter media. And I have a calcium reactor and a magnesium reactor and a refugium.
Yeah, and an apex system. And you can throw whatever you want on there.
All of that stuff.
Before we go on, I feel the need to specify that what he's describing here is a very high-tech saltwater aquarium.
Sure, yeah. It's an expensive saltwater aquarium.
Because I just had a moment where I was like, I can see people being intimidated by what we're doing. This is a high-end saltwater aquarium. This is not the quote-unquote norm.
Exactly. Exactly.
Continue.
Right. And so the argument on the internet right now is if you do all of those things and then you have dosing pumps that add all of that stuff that's getting used up in your aquarium and you test your nitrates and a nitrate reactor, which, by the way, you can do. If your nitrates and your phosphates are staying at 10, or your nitrates are staying at 10, your phosphates are staying at 0.02 to 0.04, and your calcium is maintaining at 420 to 440, and your magnesium's maintaining at 1375, and all of those things are happening the way that they're supposed to, do you still have to do water changes?
Yes.
Zero hesitation.
Zero. Which I completely, completely agree with.
I just think you can't account for everything. I just think you can't. Like, you know, you can program around every problem, but what are you missing? You're always missing something.
I think you're exactly right.
I think this is back to the recirculated air in a room analogy that came up earlier, because I'm like, you can put as many like air scrubbers in there as you want, but you're still going to know it's recirculated air. You're going to want to open a window eventually. Like, that's just how it is.
Hour six on an airplane is always going to feel the same.
Yeah. And for fish, us doing water changes, or for corals or plants, our water changes are us airing out the room a little bit here and there.
I really like that analogy. That's something that we need to remember. Airing out the room.
Yeah.
Right? We're dealing with what we call a closed system. An open system would be a pond that water flows into and water flows out of. An aquarium is a closed system. The only things that go in are what we put in, and the only things that come out are the things we take out.
Yeah. Well, even lately, I mean, we've been like, shoot, we have to dose strontium now too? What even is that? Like, you know, and so like just doing water changes, if we're matching the qualities of seawater, it should touch a couple of those things that it needs a little bit, mm-hmm. but not a ton of.
Yeah.
I mean, how much chlorine does a coral need? Probably a teeny tiny amount, maybe.
It does actually need
but
a little
it
bit.
Needs some.
Yeah.
And are we dosing that? No. Why would we do that? So just doing a water change covers your bases a little bit.
Replenishes some of those unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are some companies out there right now that are doing pretty intense water analysis on your aquarium water, where they're testing like 150 different elements. We don't have additives for all those 150 different elements, and we don't have chemical filtration media. I should say it this way. We don't have additives for all of those things that test is going to say you're lacking. We don't have chemical filtration media for all of those things that are going to build up that the tests are going to say you have too much of.
Right.
They just don't exist yet. Maybe they will someday. Maybe there'll be a lithium and adamantium.
Honestly, I'd rather do a water change.
Exactly. On some of these systems that are super well thought out and super well planned, the system that I described with a moderate to low fish load, with a really good established set of corals, a 10% water change every two weeks could be all it takes.
Right.
That could be enough. 10% every week, probably going to be a little bit better. More than that, it might not be necessary on that system. But I don't know that you're going to get away with less than that.
Yeah, filtration can get you pretty far, but not all the way to no maintenance. And I would say that even for tiny systems like jars.
Yeah.
It'll last for a while if you do no maintenance on it. But mm-hmm. I don't think there's a such thing as a closed aquarium system. It's a question we've been posed a lot of times. Mm-hmm. If you provide food, and if you provide, you know, that sort of life cycle where some can eat and live and survive, and there's no such thing as a no input aquarium, I don't think.
No, it doesn't exist. As long as you're inputting food, which I cannot think of an aquarium that you can really pull that off unless you're, Amy and I have thrown out like theoretical, like multi-hundred gallon systems. That's not within the scope of this conversation, but
theories.
As long as you're adding in something, that means you're putting something else out of whack somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like,
it's going to be converted, but it's not going to leave unless it's taken out.
And that's the thing about, like, in nature, it's by nature not a closed system. Like, even if you're looking at, like, a betta pond, that's a region of the world that's getting almost daily rain.
Right.
That means that it's functionally a daily water change.
And that rain is washing through sand, absorbing minerals. It's washing through trees, absorbing nutrients.
The only way you are going to replicate that is if you build an entire ecosystem in your backyard. And I don't mean like, oh, you're going to pull it like... You're not going to pull that off in a few dozen gallons.
You're not just
going to
throw some soil in there and some scuds and call it good. Yeah. Like, no. It's going to be a much more complex thing.
Yeah. Ecosystems are complex and layered.
Right. And more often than not, and I would even say almost all the time, not balanced. Natural ecosystems don't have the sort of balance we're trying to reach in an aquarium.
No.
Because something's always dying and something's always succeeding. I mean, nature finds ways to balance itself out, but if you're trying to say that all of your organisms are equally healthy, then you've got to be doing some input.
Yeah.
And
okay,
in nature,
so
they're not.
We've ranted. We've ranted about water changes. So filtration cannot make up for the lack of water changes.
Yeah.
You've got to do water changes. The bigger, the oversized filter for biological filtration is not going to make up for overfeeding.
Right.
And it's not going to make up for overstocking your tank.
No, never.
Never. Volume makes up for overstocking your tank.
Yeah, period. Stocking your tank appropriately makes up for overstocking your tank.
Well, but I've seen some pretty cool reef systems that had a 200-gallon display with 2,000 gallons of refugium and sump and additional stuff. 2,000 gallons. That's not an exaggeration.
No, I think that's a great idea.
It was really cool.
Yeah.
And there were way more fish than a 200-gallon aquarium could hold, but it worked.
I think more people need to be not wimps about sumps.
Yeah, big sumps. Big sumps are cool.
Yeah.
Big sumps are cool. Okay, so we're starting to talk a little bit about, we've talked about the three types of filtration. Now let's talk about different kinds of filters.
Yeah.
You guys want to start freshwater or saltwater?
Oh, let's start freshwater.
Start freshwater. Okay, so when we're talking about kinds of filters, we're talking literally about those types of things you'd buy in the store, an undergravel filter or a sponge filter or a canister filter or an internal filter or a hang on the back filter. Did I miss any?
Canisters?
Probably.
Did
no,
you say
canister?
Oh, I missed it.
Matten filter?
Corner filters?
Yeah.
I mean, mattens are a type of sponge filter.
The only other words. Yeah, I think you got pretty close to all of it.
I think so. Okay, so sponges and mattens and undergravels are going to do a successful job at managing the first two types of filtrations if maintained properly.
I think a lot of people will be surprised how many undergravel filters we have in the store.
They're pretty effective.
They are fantastic biological filters. Mm-hmm. They're fantastic mechanical filters. They tend to get gunked up.
Maintained properly, they're good.
Yeah.
As long as they're maintained properly. Did I say that enough? Is it getting like...
Well, let's talk about maintenance on them. Yeah. What do we need to do for an undergravel filter?
The reason an undergravel filter is so effective is because there's so much room for bacteria there. You grow all kinds of stuff all over every surface. And the amount of surface area a little bitty piece of gravel has is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So then you put...
You've basically just turned your entire substrate into a biological filter.
Yeah. Which happens in any aquarium, but it happens more effectively with an undergravel filter.
Because there's water passing through it.
Water is passing through it, yes. The key with those is maintained properly, and they have to be thoroughly vacuumed on a regular basis. And it's because they also address the other type of filtration, mechanical filtration. So what they are successfully doing is pulling the particulates into the substrate to get them out of the water column so they're not unsightly. But with a filter that's got a pad or a cartridge or a sponge, you pull that out and you clean it. You can't do that with your gravel.
No.
So it has to be vacuumed on a super regular basis.
Just question. How often would you say is often enough with an undergravel filter?
Every 2 weeks, vacuumed thoroughly. So here's what I would think would be like the perfect way to maintain an undergravel filter. 50% of the gravel should be vacuumed every week. And you alternate sides. I think that's perfect maintenance on undergravel, but that has to happen.
Now, I think part of the reason they've fallen out of vogue is because of the rising up of planted aquariums. I don't want to vacuum out all the good fertilization I've put in under my plants. So I don't use an undergravel filter. But I acknowledge that they're fantastic for fish-only systems.
Absolutely.
Or even lightly planted systems.
We use them here in the store because it's an extremely economical way to filter a whole bunch of tanks. Air is a lot cheaper than electricity.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and also it's an extremely efficient way to do that without having the tanks share water because they're sharing air.
Right.
So.
So then we're not mixing if we have an issue in one tank. Not that we ever have an issue in a tank.
Okay. No, I mean we're perfect. We never get disease in our tanks.
Shush.
But that water is not connected, so the disease can't transfer, which makes that's a central filtration system for a commercial environment is a very efficient way. But if those tanks are connected, disease can spread. I don't care how much underground or how much UV sterilization you do or what you do to it's going to spread.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
100%.
Yep. It's going to happen.
There's no eliminating disease in a shared system.
Nope.
I mean, if it gets in anywhere.
Well, there's no eliminating disease in a system. And if it's shared.
Yeah.
It's shared.
It is. All of it. Right. Everything.
Right.
Just like kindergartners.
Yeah. Or, you know, the world right now.
Whoops.
Yeah. So what are the other filters we use in our tanks?
So the sponge filter is kind of the similar technology to an undergravel. Just a little slightly different. So the sponge filter is still air-driven filtration. The air, the bubbles rising up, pull water with it. That pulls water into the sponge. That sponge has surface area for bacteria. That sponge collects junk. It's just a little easier to take that sponge every once in a while and squeeze it out into a bucket of used tank water.
Absolutely.
Why would we do it that way?
So you don't kill your bacteria.
Your best buddies.
You worked hard to get those. You make all those friends. Why are you unfriending them?
Yeah, the chlorine that's in tap water destroys good bacteria.
And I've heard people argue that, but I'm also would like to point out that like in a laboratory environment, we use bleach to kill basically everything. So it's just...
It's a biocide.
It's just... Chlorine.
Like, yeah.
Like, come on.
It kills everything.
Yeah. If you rinse your sponge out or clean it out really well under the sink, are you going to kill all of the bacteria? Probably not all of it. But you're definitely going to have an effect on your bacterial population on that sponge.
If you do it every week, I would say you're probably killing it off. And some people do.
They do.
Sure. Yeah.
So for me, maintenance on a sponge filter... Do your water change on your tank. Put some of your used water into a 5-gallon bucket. Take your filter, squeeze it out a couple of times in that bucket. Don't worry about getting it spotless and put it back.
Yeah. A little dirty is good in nature.
Dirt is good.
There is such a thing as a too clean aquarium.
And I would say it's more dangerous than a too dirty aquarium in a lot of cases.
I think unquestionably.
Because ammonia is far more toxic than nitrate.
Yeah.
True.
Because of that, I will admit, I don't clean out my sponge filter every time I do a water change, but, we've talked about it here. I do a lot of water changes. So every other time I do a water change,
which is every other week, which is the frequency that a lot of us do water changes.
Yep.
Yeah.
So the next step would be some kind of powered motor driven filter. There's the difference. Air-driven versus motor-driven.
Yeah.
Motor-driven.
Sure. Simple enough.
Not that you can't run an undergravel or a sponge with a power head. It works just fine. It actually works pretty effective.
Yeah.
If I want a little extra current, that's what I'm doing in the tank.
Yeah. I always use motor-driven current or motor-driven filtration because I love current in a tank. I think that tanks that flow look better.
Moving water is good.
Yeah.
Yep.
So whether it's a sponge or whatever, and really... I'm pretty much always using canisters or internals because I don't want as much gas exchange on the surface. I want that to take place in my plants.
So there's a good next topic.
Mm-hmm.
Canister filters and internal filters versus hang in the back filters.
Yeah.
All three of those are going to have some level of compartments for mechanical, chemical, and biological filtration to some degree. Some of the really nano ones are really just going to address one or two of those, not necessarily all three. But most of those, whether we're talking about a teeny little AquaClear 20 all the way up to the Owazi 350, are going to have sponges for mechanical filtration. They're going to have spots for carbon or some other chemical filtration. And they're going to have some kind of ceramic or surface area spot for biological filtration.
Yeah. I'm personally, a canister filters and internals are what I use at home. They get the flow and they still get all the pieces of it, but the amount of media you can fit in a canister versus what you can fit in the hang on the backs of equivalent, let's say, gallon rating, you can fit a lot more.
True.
Now I'm going to skew on the other side. In this situation, I prefer hang on the back filters because I'm not so much of a plant guy, so that I definitely push my system towards high oxygen,
yeah,
high gas exchange environment because I'm a fishy person. So, yeah. So I don't have to worry so much about the plants. So the hang on the back filter definitely has that nice waterfall effect that if I'm using one in a system, it gets me the extra gas exchange that I want.
Yeah, this is probably a good opportunity to talk about gas exchange and how filtration or circulation kind of feeds into that.
So I'm going to start this discussion by saying it's not the air bubbles in your tank that right. oxygenates the water. It's the surface disruption at the top of the water column that is oxygenating your water. I get that question so often. I'm not judging anyone. Right. Like you're pumping air in. Of course it's putting oxygen in. That's a very simple thing to think.
Practically speaking, if you look at how much time that bubble is in the water compared to how much time the water is in contact with the air at the surface, that bubble doesn't have enough time to push that much
oxygen. It doesn't usually pop under the water either.
Right. It doesn't have enough. It doesn't do much. What it does do is as that bubble is going up, it's bringing water with it. That's the main aeration, the main circulation that happens with bubbles in an aquarium.
The more water that... We're talking on a molecular level here. Right. I just want to be clear to the more water that is shooting across the surface of the water, the more oxygen that's getting pulled in.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. You can accomplish the exact same thing by taking a power head, putting it on the bottom of the aquarium, and pointing it up.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's what an air stone does. Sometime it would be fun to do an oxygen test on an aquarium. Somehow figure out how much water is being turned over with an air stone versus a small power head and put an oxygen sensor in there.
I will say that theoretically, these ideas are ideas I've already toyed with. So if you go downstairs right now,
okay, that makes sense.
We have a tank that I have been testing whether live rock is got anything in it. If you look at one side of the tank, I have a power head pointing up, circulating it through the water that way. And on the other side, I have an air stone pumping water the same way on the other side, just because that's just what I had at hand when I was setting it up. So I said, this will do the same thing on both sides.
Yeah. Those air bubbles moving up move a lot of water. It's impressive how much water you can get going out of those.
Yeah, and frankly, that's why I avoid that type of filtration.
Exactly.
Because I don't want my gas exchange to take place there at the surface in a planted aquarium. I want it to take place in my plants. My plants oxygenate my tank and the current flowing through them a little bit because I like to add a lot of flow to my tanks. But I don't necessarily want a lot of gas turnover because that's going to release my CO2 and introduce oxygen. And I really want that to take place in plants. That's why I use canisters. That's why I use internals.
Yep. I'm a planted person as well.
Yeah.
I agree with you 100%. That is how I do it as well. What you're getting at is a phenomenon called surface film.
Mm.
Remember when I did a talk a number of years ago at the National Convention of the American Library Association. And I did a talk, I did an aquascaping demonstration focusing on doing a cool live bearer aquarium. And in that talk, I talked a little bit about surface film. I remember some comments. So it was recorded. You can find the YouTube video. It's out there somewhere. Somebody made some comments, and I'm not that technically savvy when it comes to computers. Don't tell anyone. But somebody made a comment about, well, that person's very ill-informed about what surface film is. So the definition of surface film is the layer that forms because of the... You're going to have to help me out on the science here a little bit. I had the terms, Okay, so air and water form a different molecular charge, a polarity. And at that surface, a film occurs because of the molecular charge of the ions in the air versus in the water. Basically, a water molecule turned a certain way has a different polarity or a different charge, right? And so surface film is that little barrier that occurs there. That's what allows water striders to walk on water.
Looks like an oil slick.
Well, so the surface film doesn't look like an oil slick. The other phenomenon that happens there is because of the polarity of those molecules, they attract other ions, other molecularly charged particles. It's how a protein skimmer works.
Right.
Right? So the film is simply the water molecules reacting with the air molecules, with the atoms in the air.
Right.
It's not the slick that happens is because those molecules also attract proteins. That's how you get that rainbowy slick effect.
So it makes it look all slimy and gross.
It does. And in a polluted aquarium, that effect is going to be more dramatic. In a clean aquarium, you're still going to get a barrier, a film between air and water.
I've even seen like protein foam pop up on not well circulated aquariums that are freshwater because of that surface film.
Yes. The density of salt water makes a protein skimmer effective. You have to have a really, really dirty freshwater aquarium because it's a different density to make a protein skimmer work. It can work in a really dirty aquarium. It can pull out proteins.
I would bet it. I've seen like that. It's like is a sort of foam. It's not sea foam, but like just nasty tanks get that.
So that molecular charge. Okay, I'm going to digress here a little bit and switch over a little bit to salt water. That molecular charge that happens at that surface happens anywhere air is in contact with water. A protein skimmer works by injecting a whole bunch of teeny tiny little bubbles into a reaction chamber with a bunch of moving water. Those polar molecules, those molecularly charged molecules at the surface film attract those ions, the proteins, just like they do at that oil slick that Amy was talking about in a freshwater aquarium. That would happen in a saltwater aquarium too.
Mm-hmm.
So that happens in the reaction chamber of a protein skimmer. As those bubbles, those teeny bubbles in a protein skimmer, collect those molecules, they get more and more dense and work their way to the surface and form that foam that gets collected in the collection cup. That's very loosely the science behind what happens in a protein skimmer. Okay, so back to freshwater, that surface film also creates a barrier for oxygen and CO2. So mostly it's for CO2. So the CO2 has a harder time breaking through that surface film unless it's broken up with something like a hang on the back filter or bubbles that'll break up that surface film and allow that CO2 to escape. If you use a canister filter or an internal filter, the output and the input on those filters are below the level, below the surface. So there's less breakup that's happening at that surface that keeps the CO2 in the aquarium. If you don't have any plants, you don't want that.
Right.
If you have a whole lot of plants, the plants are going to absorb that CO2 and convert that CO2 into oxygen.
And in most tanks, I think the plants can get plenty of CO2, even if you're using a sponge filter. You can do that in a planted tank.
Okay.
But if I'm spending the money to inject CO2 into my tank,
right,
I want all of that to go to my plants. I don't want that just evaporating out into the air. So that surface film is sort of a partner in keeping the CO2 for the plants.
Right.
So that's why I use canisters and internal filters, because they don't disturb that top of the tank.
Yep.
Yeah.
So this is a fun fact. Do you know what makes water polar like that?
Hydrogen bonding and van der Waals forces.
More or less, yeah. A big part of that is, if you ever look at the structure of water, it's got the central oxygen, and the two hydrogens are not like equidistant from each other. They're kind of skewed to a side. And because of that, that creates a partial negative charge on one side and a partial positive charge on the other. And that's
hydrogen bonding.
Yep.
I don't remember what does van der Waals forces, but I know it's involved in that.
I'm not a chemist.
Those are that the two terms I remember. Right?
You just got as far as my knowledge goes.
I do remember the experiment where if you have a stream of water coming out of a faucet and you take a very powerful magnet and put it next to that stream of water, you can actually bend the water towards the magnet. That's the
science
polarity.
Is cool.
The polarity of water.
That's awesome.
So to the person who made the comments on that YouTube channel, I apologize for it taking so long for me to explain what surface film is. But hopefully that clarifies a little bit that no, I was not referring to that oily film that can build up on a dirty aquarium that doesn't have proper circulation. I was referring to the natural phenomenon of the film that allows water bugs to run across water. So there we go. So,
fair enough.
that kind of describes a little bit about there's the main kinds of filters that we'd use in a freshwater environment. That covers, I guess we can talk about wet dry filters.
We didn't really talk about hang on the backs, but that's because I think they're the probably most effective version of splitting the difference between all those things.
Yeah.
They've got good flow, they're not super agitating to the surface, they've got all the types of filtration we need. Hang on the back filters, if you're not sure what to get, is probably a pretty good bet.
I get that question often about, hey, my canister filter is more expensive, so it must be better than a hang on the back. And I don't think that's true at all.
No.
And I would rather see, if you're going to do an inexpensive, simple saltwater aquarium, or you're going to do a community tank with plastic plants, I would much prefer to see a hang on the back over a canister on those aquariums, simply because of that oxygenation that happens.
Yeah.
The canister is going to be more expensive, because you have to have a sealed thing that won't leak sitting under your aquarium.
Yeah.
A hang-in-the-back filter has less parts, doesn't need as much structure because it doesn't have to seal in the same way, and it's going to sit on the back of the tank.
And they're so simple, easy to use, but...
Easy to access.
Yeah, I would say a canister filter is absolutely worth the money, but a hang-on-the-back is pretty much just as good. I don't know how that
great.
Both works.
Yeah. For me, like in the... one tank that I have a hang on the back filter right now, I'm using it to circulate the water vertically, and then I have a power head circulating the water horizontally.
Yeah.
What fish?
Clownfish.
Clownfish. Move that water, move that water, move that
yeah.
water.
Yeah. Exactly. You were going to say wet dry. I just felt like we need to wrap up hang on the backs too, just because we sort of mentioned them and didn't totally approach them.
Wet dry filter is some crazy effective biological filtration.
Yeah.
And oxygenation, really.
And oxygenation.
It's hard to get more oxygenating than that.
Oxygenation happens when water is in contact with air. And in a wet dry filter, you splash a bunch of water over a bunch of stuff that creates these even tinier little particles of water that just have more surface area to come in more contact with air. All right, so surface area, really easy way to think about it. If you take a block that's 6 inches by 6 inches by 12 inches, or you have two blocks that are 6 inches by 6 inches by 6 inches. This is super simplified here, right? Mm-hmm. I can't do that math. So the two places where those 2 6-inch blocks would be touching each other, think of how much surface area you're losing if they're connected than if they're separate, right?
Right.
Basically, what that comes down to is the smaller the particle in the same volume, the more surface area you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. And another way to think about it is that if you're doing like a 2-inch by 2-inch by 2-inch cube, and then you're doing a 4-inch by 4-inch by 4-inch cube, the 4-inch cube isn't twice as big volume wise. It's like, I think it's 4 times as big.
Something crazy like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what a wet dry filter does is it takes a whole bunch of the bio ball is their famous word. And it's this little thing the size of a ping pong ball, roughly.
Yeah.
That's got all these little grooves and nooks and crannies in it that really just drive up the amount of surface area. If you take one of those bio balls and spread them out, each bio ball just has a ton of, like, I don't even know what the number is. Some of them say it's like the 10 square feet or something from each bio ball. Some crazy number. I don't know.
But it is certainly a lot. I mean, they're well designed.
Yes. So, okay, boom, home for bacteria. Home for lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of bacteria. Now, anyone who's ever been to a lake, gone swimming, tried to climb out of tried to climb around where there's a rock wall or where there's a post on a dock, the slipperiest part is right at that surface.
True.
Right? Why is it slippery?
Bacteria.
Why are rocks in rivers that get splashed constantly, wet rocks, why are they slippery? It is not the water that's making them slippery.
It's bacteria.
So that wet, dry filter is so much surface area for
bacteria.
Thanks, Charles.
This is what we have Charles for.
That's the effectiveness of a wet, dry filter. A wet, dry filter usually has some kind of a pad that goes on the top. That's your mechanical filtration. The bio balls for home for
bacteria.
I couldn't resist doing it one more time. And then there's other chambers in there that you can put some kind of chemical filtration media like carbon.
Well, he's stewing about how he wants to frame that real quick. Let me just say, for things like your pad or your filter sock, the really nice thing about them in most filter situations is that you can exchange them.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that, like, let's say our 220. I normally frame it to two people, like we have two filter socks in there. If I was going to have that system in my home, I would buy four filter socks so that while two of them are getting cleaned, I can have two clean ones in there at any given time. Yeah.
And it's not even you can exchange them. You can wash them.
Yes.
That's amazing.
That's the thing about mechanical filtration. We're just collecting stuff. You can wash stuff out. Particles. You can wash particles out.
Gunk.
And if you're doing it often enough, you're getting it out before it rots in your system.
Right.
Mechanical filtration isn't absorbing anything. It's not growing anything. I mean, it's going to, but the goal of it is not to grow anything. It's not to absorb things. It's just to catch stuff.
Get rid of it before it becomes a problem.
Right. So it can all be rinsed out.
Yeah. If you're tossing half a can of fish food in your tank every day, it's not getting rid of it before it becomes a problem. But if you're feeding normally, then it will catch some of those particles.
There is no solution to overfeeding other than not overfeeding.
Right.
It sounds stupid, but the amount of times that we have to address that issue, I'm not going to do that today. But
right,
just don't overfeed your tank, and don't feed too much, and don't feed more than your fish need, and don't overfeed your tank. And oh, by the way, don't overfeed your tank.
Yeah, but if you've got good mechanical filtration, it will make up for slight overages of feeding.
The occasional.
Yes, the occasional. Overage.
Yeah.
It will catch it before it becomes a problem, as long as you're exchanging it when you need to or cleaning it when you need to. Right.
So I interrupted Ben's thought. Carbon.
Wah, wah.
So, carbon is an amazing chemically absorbing filter media.
It's, off the top of my head, cannot think of something better.
Right. It collects so much stuff. An amazing amount of stuff.
But that's the problem.
Right. Often in good ways, but not always in good ways. The science behind it is still not completely understood. About 10 years ago, there was this amazing study that came out in this, I think it was C-Scope, was this publication that was around for a while. It was a free publication that we'd get with, when we ordered from our saltwater wholesaler, we'd get 100 copies of C-Scope. And in there was a study done on the smoking gun for what causes hole in the head and lateral line erosion in tanks. Which, it's less common now, but it used to be a really big thing in saltwater fish, particularly in tangs and angelfish, where they would get these holes. And it's hole in the head, lateral line erosion. Think of the nastiest look you can think of that. That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
The head eventually would, the skin and the tissue around the head would actually erode.
It's horrible.
It's horrible.
I've seen fish where I can make out like structures in the skull.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are some anecdotal evidence about some nutrient deficiencies and some symptoms caused from excess nitrates. That there's probably some truth to those things, but there hasn't been a conclusive study on what nutrients are missing or what high nitrates or lack of nutrition can do to cause that. There has, however, been a very conclusive study done on carbon. Powder brown tangs, classic, beautiful, amazing, common aquarium tang, a little on the touchy side, particularly when it comes to ick, but once they're established, they're great. Two identical systems. In one system, I'm going to paraphrase here a little bit because I know this is a little long-winded, but in one of those systems, they used tons and tons of carbon. Otherwise, the filtration was the same. And in the other one, they did not use any carbon ever. Nutrition was the same. Filtration other than carbon was the same. Water quality parameters were kept as close as possible. In fact, the water quality, the measurable parameters didn't change even though one of them had carbon. The tank containing carbon, the tang showed quick and early signs of holding the head lateral line erosion that quickly progressed as the experiment went on. So in other words, it continually got worse with carbon. The one without showed zero signs of holding the head lateral line erosion. Take that one step further, remove the carbon, and it mostly healed. There was some scarring, but the tang mostly healed. And it was done in that using the proper scientific methods and all of that methodology was there. But the use or overuse of carbon has been identified as a smoking gun for a main cause of hole in the head lateral line erosion.
I so believe that. The only time we ever see that disease is in cases of poorly maintained or poorly understood saltwater systems. It's right. Trade in fish. That's where I see it.
Yeah.
Occasionally, if fish that have been in copper for too long start to develop a little bit of it.
Yeah.
But that's the only time I see advanced stages of that disease are poorly cared for or poorly understood systems.
Right. And that's the thing about carbon. It's amazing at pulling almost everything out of the water.
It pulls a lot of stuff
out. And that includes the good stuff in your water. So with that knowledge, I would say I'm not a planet guy, but you should never be using carbon in a planet aquarium under any circumstance, because unless you're trying to pull something specific out, I'm disagreeing with that. Because it's so good at pulling stuff out. If you're dosing anything, it's probably negating that to some degree.
Yeah, and by the way, don't use it on your teeth either. People are doing that now.
On their teeth?
Yeah. Activated carbon or charcoal as toothpaste to pull out impurities. But it's teeth. They're porous. So anyway. But like,
talk about a digression.
But it does. It like directly out of tissue of fish. I mean, that lateral line is so shallow and sensitive that it pulls the gunk, the stuff out of there that they need.
The study actually postulated that it's either doing one of two things. It's either pulling out something we don't know they need, or the carbon is breaking down and putting little bitty bits of carbon into the pores of the lateral line and causing the degradation that way.
Yeah.
And it was inconclusive as to exactly what it's doing.
But either way, gross.
So carbon can effectively be used as a temporary, I need to pull something out of this tank. And that really can be pretty broad stroke.
Yeah. A clarifier.
I got a lot of tannins in my tank.
Yeah. Put some carbon in for a couple of weeks and then take it out. That's the kicker, is you got to take it out.
Great solution to a problem.
Right.
If you have a problem.
A temporary solution to a problem. And even if you're looking for that amazing crystal clear water all the time, carbon is a great way to achieve that. As long as you don't keep it in there 24/7, 365. So my little method for determining that is using a white piece of paper. So tape a white piece of paper to the short side of your aquarium and look at it. If it looks white, you don't need carbon. Okay, there might be some circumstances. Yeah. Like you medicated your aquarium and you want to put the medication
right,
out.
Well, or whatever, right, whatever.
But in a normal aquarium, if it that looks white, don't put carbon in your tank. If you have carbon in your tank and it looks white, take the carbon out. If it doesn't look white, if it looks a little bit off color, and it can get that kind of dingy old t-shirt white.
Yeah.
Not so white anymore. Antique white is what we used to call it in the painting. Put carbon in whatever spot in your filter it belongs, and keep it in there for 2, maybe 3 weeks. After 2 or 3 weeks, don't do the paper test again to see if you need more carbon. Just take the carbon out. If that's not making your tank pure and clean, not making that paper white, there's something else going on in the aquarium. Doing that 3 or 4 times a year, nothing wrong with it. In fact, I could even say that might be a good thing. Maybe we should do a little bit more of that. Changing carbon out in your aquarium every 3 weeks to make sure you always have new carbon in your aquarium is bad.
Treat it like chemical filtration. Treating a problem, and when you're done with the problem, you don't need to continue.
Yep, I like it. I like it. Chemical filtration in saltwater aquariums.
Complicated.
Really, we talked about protein skimmers pretty effectively. I think,
yeah.
I think we get that. Yes, put a protein skimmer in your saltwater aquarium. It's great. I don't put them in aquariums smaller than 40 gallons most of the time because I can do bigger water changes.
Yeah.
And I don't like a lot of the little bitty protein skimmers.
If you're doing an aquarium less than 40 gallons, you just need to be conscious about responsible stocking. Like, you can't be loading it up with the amount of fish that you would need a protein skimmer on that tank. Yeah. Otherwise, that tank's just not going to be maintainable.
Yeah. I get that question a lot where it's like, so I have a 15-gallon aquarium and I would like to put in two clowns, a royal grama, and I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Slow down.
You had me at two clowns.
Yeah.
But I want little tanks. No, that's a whole topic for different.
Nope.
There's no such thing as a little tank.
But yeah, filtration to treating the problems in a saltwater tank. Phosphate reactors, fantastic. Yeah.
Now, in a big reef aquarium with lots of corals, phosphate absorbing filter media should be in there 24/7, 365. Phosphates are enemy number one. That's too big a word. Phosphates are a really big issue.
They're on the FBI most wanted list.
They're hard to manage with just water changes.
Yes. Yep. So chemical filtration in a big reef aquarium. Phosphate absorbing filter media. The occasional use of carbon. The protein skimmer does a tremendous amount of chemical filtration media. And then there are some other filter media that we use to address certain problems. Polybiomarine polyfilters. Love them.
Yeah.
They're great.
If you're not familiar with that product, it is simply a filter pad.
This sounds like a YouTube video.
we should talk about that.
Yes. For those of you that just listened to our podcasts, thank you. It is a polymer, not encrusted, a polymer infused filter pad that changes color as it takes stuff out.
Beautiful.
I use them as not only a way to absorb impurities in a saltwater aquarium, but also a test of how good the filtration is doing.
So for example, like I mentioned earlier, a tank where I'm testing to see if there is anything in live rock that we got traded in.
Right.
I'm running it with a polyfilter because if it changes certain colors, that means there's some sort of chemical in the rock that means we can't put it in a reef tank.
Right. Like copper.
Yes.
So when they're used in a normal aquarium to do normal stuff, when normal things are happening, they slowly turn a classic organic brown. They start out white, they fade to cream, they go to tan, they get darker and they get darker and they get darker. And after about 6 to 8 weeks, if they're a medium brown color, it's time to change it. And you can just kind of look at it and see there's no white left. It's thorough. It's done. Time to put in a new one.
Put them out to pasture.
And if that happens over the course of 6 to 8 weeks, things are happening as they should in an aquarium. I've had aquariums where we put one in and 4 days later it was brown.
Yikes.
Something's wrong.
Yeah.
or you did something crazy. Like the, have you seen the polyfilter that we pulled out right before we treated Kemi Clean?
No.
It's insane. Because we kept, for background, we kept stirring up the substrate to try and catch stuff, and we put on a UV sterilizer. Oh, it was killing something.
What color did it turn?
Oh, it's like, it's almost like a sludgy brown.
Sludgy brown.
And was in for like a week and a half.
Because there's just so much particulate in the water, plus all the other things that we were doing to try and get rid of that cyanobacteria.
Right. Yep.
We had a service tank that... After many, 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 many months, we convinced them to stop feeding their Red Devil hot dogs and chicken.
Oh, barf.
Sorry, quick flashback. I just had, like, reading a story of, like, a giant gourami that was addicted to Kit Kats. I didn't even, I didn't even remember where that memory came from, but wow.
Right.
They might have been giving this Red Devil Kit Kats, too.
It wouldn't surprise me a bit. It turned the polyfilter dark, dark brown in 3 days.
Ugh, yuck.
I was impressed. I didn't even know they could turn that quickly. But the other thing that polyfilters do is if they're absorbing copper, they turn blue.
Yeah.
If they're absorbing excess iron, they turn red. There's something else that they can turn yellow if they're absorbing something else.
I think it's ammonia.
Ammonia or sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's ammonia, they turn yellow. If it's sulfur, they turn black.
And then I think they turn green for something else. I can't remember.
Yeah, they're a great diagnostic tool while also helping solve the problem.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Chemical filtration media. C-Chem makes Purigen... all kinds of
Purigen is great for organics. I mean, pretty much if you have a problem, you can solve it with chemical filtration. Yep.
All of those, lots of companies make some phenomenal chemically absorbing filter media.
Yeah.
That are very, very useful in saltwater aquariums.
Yeah, I think that's probably something that we will need to really delve into in future podcasts or videos, because we could talk all day about different chemical solutions for saltwater.
It's true.
I mean, there's so many amazing things that solve problems we deal with every day.
Right. I just picture that as like a game show where it's like, I'll take chemical filtration for 50.
Sure. I would play it.
I think we should do that.
Yeah, like it would be very fun.
So, did we confuse you? Did we explain stuff? Did we make it easier? Did we make it harder? The big takeaway from this is there's the three types of filtration. That's what it's got to do. It doesn't clean your tank. That's your job. It keeps your water healthy.
Yeah.
Right? That's what they do. They don't clean.
Yeah. Filtration takes things and makes them other things.
Yes. Exactly.
I wish the audience could have seen the face that he just turned and gave me. He was like, oh, that was so well said.
It doesn't clean your tank. That's your job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Well.
What kind of filters do you guys use and why?
Exactly. That's it. Why? Tell me what you use and why. The strive for the perfect filtration, I still don't have it.
It's because
really good ideas, but one
we all disagree on which ones we like the best. Yeah. Right.
It's almost like we have different aquarium keeping styles,
and different filters are better for them. Well, we would still love to hear from you. You can even email podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com. Even if you just want to give us some feedback on how we're doing and how much you're either enjoying or not enjoying this podcast. Hopefully, if you've gotten this far, you are enjoying it. And be sure to look us up on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and just get in touch with us wherever you can.
Come visit us in the gallery.
Absolutely.
And I've been working on some science-y YouTube videos. Excellent. So if you have particular topics that you want, demystified feels like a big word. But
that's a good demystified. If
you want that, a specific topic, please message us, Facebook, whatever, because I'm always looking for ideas.
Even if you just want to commiserate about how overwhelming and complicated something is, I'm sure we could help you with that too.
Exactly.
Well, coming up soon will be our next top 5 list. In the meantime, have lots of fun and keep those hands wet.